Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bio-231, Human Anatomy, and it's January 27th. We're sort of in the middle of the cell chapter, so we're going to finish cell chapter today. But I think I need to talk a little bit about organization of the class, and maybe at the end of class I want to talk about that first practicum, how you study for that first practicum, okay, what will be required of you to do that. All right, on the screen, notice that we're taking a quiz, and I want to show you in Blackboard, if you make an error while taking the quiz, what are the icons and what does that mean and how we're going to handle that information. All right, so how long do we have to take this quiz? And it's the same for any quiz in here, whether it's a forever quiz or the weekly online quizzes that are due Tuesday at 11 p.m., you only get 10 minutes. Now, you can run long, but that shifts the computer around a little bit and gives you an icon. It doesn't tell you what your grade is. Right, then I have to go in and manually grade every question, so that's a real hassle. So that's basically why there's a little bit of a penalty associated with running long, because I can't possibly go back and regrade everybody's question, right, if you run long, because there's just not enough time in the day to do that. So we're going to let this time out, but in order for it to time out, we got to at least finish it, okay? So what do you do? Click an answer. I don't know if that's the right answer or not, but if we want that answer, we'd like that answer. What should we do to proceed to the next question? Yeah, don't click save, right? As a matter of fact, don't click anything. You can click this tiny, tiny little arrow right there, but I wouldn't click anything. I would just hit enter and then enter. That will take you to the next question. If you hit save, that will bomb the program. All right, so and then here's a multiple answer one. You got to pick maybe a couple of those things. Do you want to click? No, don't click. What should you do? Enter, enter. All right, and then here's reliable. Warning. Oh, look at that. You get a nice warning like that. I didn't know that. Okay. And then what? Enter, enter. Another question. Okay. Let's just. Oh, I was going to click save. Ah, don't click save. That will hurt. Okay. When taking an online quiz, never click the save button. True. What should you do? Enter, enter. All right. And then number six. Oh, I have no idea. Okay, we'll click that one and then enter, enter. Got to choose maybe a couple answers for this one. All right. And then enter, enter. And we got 20 seconds to answer this question. Okay. All right, so I'm not going to enter this one right away because I want it to time out in just 10 seconds. What happens when you get to 10 minutes? Maybe nothing. All right, so you just got to pay attention. Ah, so now we're over the 10-minute period. So we'll probably get an error message, all right, which will be an exclamation point icon in your grade sheet. So I'm happy with this answer. Let's do enter, enter. All right, so let's go OK to see our results. Okay, so you can see which ones we got correct and which ones incorrect. All right, we'll hit OK. Ah, what happened? Blackboard. Now, how do I find my grades? Tools. My grades. Okay, so here are a couple of the forever quizzes that I've taken, but I didn't complete them properly. One, we went over time on, right? The internet connection evaluation quiz. We went long on it. So you get an exclamation point right there. And if you run long on any on the weekly online quizzes, for every minute you get docked a point. Okay, even if it's just a second over 10 minutes. So pay really close attention to that. And then I will go in and manually grade your quiz and give you the number that you got right minus whatever the penalty is. Right. Here is another icon right here, a piece of paper with a pencil on it. That means you didn't do the quiz correctly. Maybe you hit the save button, or maybe you tried to backtrack. All right. Those are the two main reasons that you get this kind of symbol. And you don't see your grade, but if you come in and see me during office hours, I'll manually grade that quiz for you and give you the proper points for it. All right. I can't reset the quiz. But we'll go over it, right? And maybe we'll even take a quiz together just so you get the mechanics of taking a quiz, right? Enter, don't click the save button. And you should be doing really well on the quizzes after that. So you can practice taking quizzes online because you have these two forever quizzes here. And just get in the proper mechanics of taking a quiz and you should be able to do really well. And lots of people got 100% on that first online quiz. Right, if you didn't get 100% on it, right, maybe you want to reread the instructions or talk to me, and you know you should be able to get 100% on those quizzes, okay, the online quizzes. You really should be able to do that. All right, and so that's what I would be looking forward to do. So you get this kind of error icon, see me, we'll correct it. This one I will just automatically correct on myself. You don't have to see that one, okay, but please don't do that because it's going to cost course points. Who's got a question? Anybody have a question about what we were just talking about yet? Is there anything I can clear up pretty easily? Yeah. Yeah, that's a forever quiz. The syllabus quiz is there because you get some extra credit points, but it also tests you on the knowledge on how you take the class, like can you make up tests and do you have to be in class, right? Just some of the protocols, that kind of thing. And it also lets you practice just taking quizzes, 10 minutes, right? Don't hit the save button. Don't go back. The other thing that it does is that it kind of checks your internet connection. Because if your computer times out or your internet connection isn't good, then you won't finish the quiz and you'll get an error icon. And then you know you got to do something, right? Maybe come to campus and take the quiz, the official quiz on campus where things work pretty well. All right, or maybe you're thinking about getting a different internet connection or take it someplace else. But you know what? A lot of people use a laptop. And you know what happened last time? The batteries in the laptop died. And the computer shut down during the quiz. Oh, that's a killer. That's too bad. All right, so make sure you're plugged into AC power or your batteries are fully charged. And if you're on a laptop, you can take your quiz in different parts of the house or different locations in the world. And they don't all have the same internet connection, right? Some parts of your house might, if it's a wireless, might have a good connection. Maybe if you go way, you're going to take it in the backyard or something. If it's nice out, you don't have a really good internet connection, and the internet connection might fail while you're taking a quiz. So get to a place in your house where you know you have a strong internet connection. Do the ping test and bandwidth test. Take the forever quizzes, and if all that looks good, right, whenever you take a quiz, go to that part of the house where you know things work. All right, maybe certain time of day too, right? Like when after everybody goes to bed or something. And take the phones off the hook so you don't get interrupted, that kind of stuff. Okay. So yeah, you can practice the mechanics of taking a quiz, and while you're doing that, you're checking your internet connection via your computer. So you should know. Okay. Yeah, so nice, good question. Any other question? No? Okay. All right, so let's move back to the lecture. Let's start with these couple questions right here. What is cytoplasm? What the heck is cytoplasm? I'll give you a hint. It's got two parts. Cytoplasm has two parts. Is cytoplasm outside the cell or inside the cell? It's inside the cell. What are the two parts of junk that's inside the cell? Cytosol, which is the fluid part, and organelles, which are the more structural components that make up a cell, right? So you got organelles and cytosol make up cytoplasm. All right, and then here's just something I kind of made up. What is nucleoplasm? Where would you find nucleoplasm? Inside the nucleus, all the junk inside the nucleus. There's a fluid part to it, and there's more solid type material like chromosomes inside the nucleus, right? So all of that makes up the living substance with inside the nucleus. All right, so let's talk a little bit about the nucleus. And let's just go to this picture right here. And this might be an exam figure, I'm not sure. Well, you know, the big cell, the big picture of the cell that has all the organelles, you should be able to recognize those, right? Like this one right here. So here is the nucleus. It is a membrane-bound organelle. And I'm not sure I describe what it means to be membrane-bound, but it just means some organelles are membrane-bound and some are not. And if it's membrane bound, that's just a short way of saying that it is surrounded by a membrane. All right, so some organelles that are surrounded by a membrane are mitochondria, endoplasmic reticulum. Other organelles that don't have a membrane around them would be like the ribosome, right? And centrioles and microtubules, they don't have membranes around them. So you could think of organelles as belonging to one of two of those different camps. Can anybody think of another organelle that is membrane bound inside the cell of all the ones that we talked about? Maybe I'll ask, and you can say yes or no. What about cilia? No, it's not membrane bound. Golgi body. Which one is that? Membrane bound or not? Yes, membrane bound. What about a vesicle? Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's got a membrane around it. Okay, so that's another way that you could think of organelles. And the nucleus has a membrane around it, so you should probably think of that as a membrane-bound organelle. As a matter of fact, there's two membranes around it. There's an inner and an outer, right? And once we get inside the nucleus, that is where the genetic material is contained, right? So the DNA is inside the nucleus, and the DNA contains the information on how to physically build your body. What is your body going to be like? But not only that, but it contains the information on how, not only how your body is made, but how it functions as well. So it contains information on how your body should function, but also how it should look and how it is put together. And that information is arranged in chromosomes. Chromosomes are made from a nucleic acid that we call DNA, right? So DNA makes chromosomes, and chromosomes are very long, super thin filaments. And so you could think of it as a really, really tiny thread that's extremely long. And so it's actually pretty fragile. It can break when that happens. And when a chromosome breaks, that usually produces death in the cell, because now the cell doesn't really know how to function because of that break. There's a corruption in the information. Doesn't know how to rebuild or repair itself, and so that usually signals cell death. So it's very important to protect DNA in chromosomes, especially if the information is pulled off in these very fine filaments. And when it is, we call that extended chromatin. So when we look at this cell right here, I don't really see chromosomes or DNA. It just has kind of a homogeneous look to it. That means that there's thin filaments of chromosomes all over the place, and it's very, very fragile. But in order for the cell to use the information in DNA, it has to be in an extended form like we see right here. Okay, so that's the job of these nuclear membranes right here, is to protect the DNA from other things that are happening inside the cell, so it doesn't get lost or damaged. All right, so I think of the nucleus kind of as a special part inside the library that we have over here. There's a special division in the library. I might have to close this door. Okay, does anybody know what part of the library? This is where I have your textbook. Where do I have your textbook that you can check out? What's it called? The reserve section in the library, right? So the reserve section is where we put books that are real expensive, and maybe some books are irreplaceable. Once you lose those books, you can't even get another one. Maybe there's only one copy in the world. You put it in a special part of the library called the reserve section, and that protects that book from being lost or damaged. And so that's the job of the nucleus right here, this nuclear membrane, to protect the information in DNA right here when it is in an extended form. This dark area right here that we call the nucleolus, that's the active part of the nucleus. That's where the special things are happening, okay? That's where RNA is being made. That's the most active part of the nucleus. And so it looks a little bit darker. All right, so if you're going to tell me a function of the nucleus, right, these nuclear membranes right here, what would you say? Just like for mitochondria, what would you say? Just give me a bullet point. What's the function of mitochondria? Make ATP. What's the function of the nucleus, or this nuclear membrane right here? Protects the DNA from corruption. What about the nucleolus? That's the, yeah, it makes RNA, or you could say that's the active part. That's the most active part of the nucleus, right? Because there's a lot of living processes happening right here. All right, so chromosomes are made out of DNA, and that information is converted into RNA, and that RNA has to get into the cytoplasm in order to do its job. And it's, in most cases, it can't get through the nuclear membrane, so it has little passageways right here to leave. So information can leave the nucleus and go into the cytoplasm via these nuclear pores. All right, so these are important for translocation of information. All right, so we talked about all the organelles now inside the cell. And you'll see, don't forget, let's work with building blocks. What's the building block of life? That's a cell. What's the building block of a cell? Organelles, right. You need to put a bunch of organelles together to make a cell, right? And you might wonder, well, why does a cell have all of these organelles? We talked about their specific functions, right? But why does a nice, complicated, sophisticated cell like those that make up our body have organelles? And there are other organisms like bacteria that don't have organelles. What's the big deal about organelles? What makes us a lot better than bacteria? Because we have organelles. Why do our cells have organelles, but less sophisticated organisms don't? What's the advantage to us? So what I like to think of is a building. Okay, and so let's just think of the SCM building right here. And is it just one big, huge, hollow auditorium? Or when you walk inside, what do you see? Yeah, you got different rooms. And why do we have different rooms inside this building and not just one big auditorium where everything is going on at one time? Yeah, we have different subjects. So next door, we might have a math class or chemistry class or physics. Here we got anatomy. Upstairs, we got a couple physiology labs and chemistry labs, physics and engineering. We've got the dean who's running the building and the secretaries and everybody else. Right, maybe a couple SI sessions going on. Well, if all that was going on in one room, what would happen to each one of those individual activities? Well, there'd be mass confusion. They would interfere with each other. It might be really nice you could graduate in just one semester, right, by signing up for math and anatomy and physiology and just go to a place where it's all taught at the same time, but what would happen? It would just be mass confusion, right? So the building is broken up into other smaller structures so that different processes can happen at the same time, exactly the same time, without interfering with each other. So that's the purpose of organelles, so that very nice, sophisticated processes can all happen at the same time without interference. That's the beauty of organelles. And now you know the names of some of those processes that take place. Okay. All right, so let's talk about movement across the plasma membrane. What does the plasma membrane separate? What does it separate? It's a membrane. It's separating something. What's a plasma membrane separating? Can you picture where it is in your mind? Where is the plasma membrane? It's the same thing as the cell membrane, right? Plasma membrane and the cell membrane are the same thing. It separates the outside world with the living inside world. It's a separation between the two. Well, the living processes inside the cell need to get materials from the outside world to stay alive, like energy, for instance, and maybe ions, electrolytes. All right, so there are different ways that molecules can move across the membrane, and that's really important because the cell might produce some toxic compounds that it needs to get rid of, and it has to move that from inside to outside through the plasma membrane. So transport processes are very important. There are two main kinds of transport processes. They can be considered either passive or active. And what that means, all right, is that a passive process is just a process that happens automatically. Okay? It does not require energy whatsoever. Right, an active process, in order for it to happen, requires energy. And guess what the form of energy is inside your cell that can make things happen? It's ATP. That's right. So active processes require ATP. All right, so if you have a passive process, all right, let's think of a passive process. And I know when I was in college, I had this car that I had to work on almost every weekend. It was about as long as this desk right here. It was an MGB. I don't know if anybody knows what an MGB is. Raise your hand if you ever heard of an MG. Little tiny car, English car, okay? And it was breaking down all the time. The battery would be dead sometimes. The starter motor, when I turn the key, sometimes it just go grind, 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 right? So I have to work on it all the time. But it was kind of nice because it had a clutch, a manual transmission, right? So if I didn't know if I could start the car when I got out of work or school, guess where I would park the car? I would park it on top of a hill like this. Okay? Ah, you did that last night or something, some of you, I can tell when you left. All right, so does it require gasoline in this car to go down the hill? No, right? I could just put my foot out the door, give it a little kick, because it was a really small car, and it would start going down the hill. I would pop the clutch and get the car started, and I could drive home. So that was a really nice advantage of having a little car like that. So going down is what kind of process? Active or passive? That's passive. Right. That's passive. Now what if I was down here and I needed to get up here? Is that active or passive? Now that's active. All right, in terms of a cell, which one of these processes need ATP? Active. Okay. So here you need ATP. So now let's, instead of thinking about my car, let's think about molecules that are going to move from one place to another. And I have a perfume bottle right here, and there's no perfume in the room. And I open the perfume bottle, and it's going to evaporate into the air right here. And even though there's no fans or breeze in the room, guess what's going to happen to those perfume molecules that are right here? You're probably aware of this. They're going to move. They're going to move from here all the way to the back of the room due to a concentration gradient, a concentration difference, meaning it will go from an area of high concentration right where the bottle is to where the concentration is very low or zero in the back of the room. So it's going to move, right? And that is a passive process. We call that diffusion. All right, so that is diffusion, a passive process. And it's due to what? A concentration gradient. Concentration. And how is it going to move? Just like my diagram right here. How are those molecules going to move just all by themselves? From high to low. So for diffusion to work, right, they can only move from high to low right here. And if we leave that perfume bottle open all night long, close the doors, the concentration of perfume in the air in the front of the room is going to be the same as the back. The concentration is going to be the same everywhere in the room. What can you tell me about diffusion when the concentration of that perfume is the same everywhere in the room? What happens to diffusion? It stops. Okay, so when there's no concentration gradient, things can't move. Because if you consider that experiment just a little bit further, in no case, after opening up this perfume bottle and letting it diffuse, in no case, at no time would it ever happen that all the perfume ends up in the back of the room and none down here. Right? So as the concentration is equal, everything stops. That's equilibrium. Okay? So for passive processes like diffusion, how does it go? How do molecules move? From high concentration to low, just like my car right here, okay? And if it goes the other way, that requires ATP, okay? That would be an active process. Okay, so diffusion and osmosis. I didn't talk about osmosis yet, but that's a special case of diffusion. All molecules in a liquid or a gas can move according to the concentration gradient, and our bodies are special because it has some things that are not just found everywhere in the world, namely membranes. And our bodies are dissolved in a solvent, a liquid. Does anybody know what liquid our bodies are dissolved in? What's a very important liquid inside our bodies? Water, the water molecule. right? So osmosis is diffusion of that very special molecule, namely water, across a membrane. All right, but it still can only, water can only go from what concentration, if it's passive, from high to low, right? So carbon dioxide, oxygen can move from high to low, but that's not osmosis. It actually has to be only the water molecule across the membrane. Okay, let's talk a little bit about some active transport processes. Right. Since energy is available, ATP, adenosine triphosphate, can be broken down. That T right there stands for three atoms of phosphate, which is an element on this molecule right here. One of those phosphates can be broken off, and when it does, that releases a lot of energy that your cell can use for whatever purposes, maybe to think a thought or to contract a muscle or to move something around. And when that phosphate comes off, that only leaves two on the molecule, and so we call that adenosine diphosphate, right? Di meaning two, tri meaning three. And this would be inorganic phosphate right here. So now molecules can actually move from low concentration to high concentration, as long as you have energy to put in there. So for instance, if we have that perfume bottle again, and we open it up and automatically let things happen, what's going to happen to perfume in the room? It's going to go everywhere until the concentration is equal. All right, so that just happens automatically. And some people might say, well, you know what? The opposite can never happen. You can never go from low concentration to high concentration. Remember, there's really high concentration of perfume in the bottle, right? Some people say, well, perfume can't go from the air into the bottle, right? That would be from low concentration to high, right? But that's allowed because why? What do you know for sure? Why is that possible? Because how did that perfume get in the bottle in the first place? Well, somebody got really ambitious and learned how to take all these perfume molecules and concentrate them and package them in that bottle. All right, but when you do that, what does that require? It takes, going from low to high, it takes energy. Yeah, it takes energy to do that, right? So there had to be machines that you plug into the wall or something, right, to concentrate the perfume inside that bottle. All right, so here are some processes, specific processes, molecular transport. And macromolecular transport. Let's see what kind of pictures I have right here. All right, macromolecular transport. Here we have, all right, some particles that are outside the cell in the extracellular fluid. Here we have cytoplasm, right? And the cell membrane can move around. It can form a dimple in the surface of the cell, and then it can start to surround or swallow up particles that are in solution over here. All right, so here we have the cell membrane invaginating, surrounding a particle. And then if this process continues, this little narrowing right here will actually fuse together, and this little bubble that it right now is attached to the cell membrane will pinch away from the cell membrane and move inside the cell. So this particle, which was in the extracellular fluid, is now really inside the cell. So that takes energy to move these membranes around like that. That takes ATP. So this process of taking material that's outside the cell and bringing it in inside of a vesicle, that's called phagocytosis or cell eating. Cell eating. All right, these other little substances that we have here could be things like salts or glucose that are dissolved in solution. And when this invagination happens, right, there could be fluid inside this little vesicle that contains glucose, and it pinches away. And so now you have a solution of chemicals inside the vesicle that are inside the cell. That's a special kind of cell eating, but that's not phagocytosis. We call that cell drinking or pinocytosis. Right, so phagocytosis and pinocytosis are very similar. It's just the nature of the particles that are a little bit different. Okay, here's a sign-in sheet. Go ahead, sign the sign-in sheet and pass it around. If you don't find your name on there, go ahead, write it at the bottom of the list. Okay, but make sure you sign in. Okay, so both of the, yeah?
Is that also known
as endocytosis? Okay, so phagocytosis and pinocytosis are endocytosis. So endocytosis is the general term for anything that's entering the cell. The two ways that you could think about that is if it's eating a big particle, that's phagocytosis. If it's drinking fluid, that would be pinocytosis. All right, so not only can things enter the cell, but things can be secreted from the cell or excreted from the cell. This process can happen in the reverse. You can have a vesicle inside the cell, and it can move over to the cell membrane. All right, so here we have a nice Golgi apparatus. Who can remember the functions of the Golgi apparatus? Packaging and modification. Yeah, modification and packaging. So it's modified some proteins, maybe added a sugar molecule, making a mucopolysaccharide, and we have that mucus in this vesicle. It moves over to the cell membrane. How does it get over to that cell membrane? What does it hop a ride on? Microtubules. Yeah, those microtubules that are coordinated by the centrioles, right? So it moves this vesicle over to the cell membrane, and it fuses with the cell membrane, so whatever contents were inside the vesicle now get secreted to the outside of the cell. And so this is a case of exocytosis. So the opposite of endocytosis, which is what? Phagocytosis and pinocytosis, is exocytosis. And what we see right here is a nice secretory pathway, starting with protein synthesis in the rough ER, modifying and packaging in the Golgi apparatus, and then eventually that secretory vesicle moves over here. All right, now what could you tell me about the very basic nature of a cell membrane? What's a good model that maybe you should have in your mind that describes a cell membrane? What's the internal structure look like? One layer or two layers? Two layers. All right, two layers of phospholipids. We call that the phospholipid bilayer. And remember, it's very, very fluid. It's like a film. All right, and you maybe played around with something that kind of looks like that. Did you ever, or your kids, get a soap bottle with a little hoop, and you stick the hoop in the soap, and you wave it around in the air, and it forms what? These little bubbles that are very light and they can float around, right? And it's just a film. And sometimes you get a couple bubbles and they'll be floating around and they touch each other. A lot of times they just break when they touch each other, snap. But sometimes when two bubbles touch each other, what happens? It just forms a bigger bubble. So why is it really easy for two smaller bubbles to form a big bubble? What can you tell me about the surface of the bubble? Are the two bubbles the same or different? It's the same material. So when they touch each other, it's very easy just to form one big bubble. The same thing with membranes. All membranes are basically phospholipid bilayers, and they can fuse together or pinch off from each other, just like that soap bubble, because it's very similar. Okay. So that's easy for a cell to do. Oh, here's a lysosome. What's the function of a lysosome? Just for a quick review, since it's there. Digestion. Yeah, it's an intracellular digestive system. It can digest things. Right? It has hydrolases that break compounds down. Okay. All right, so that's movement across membranes. Don't forget, both there are two. The two main ones, passive and active. All right, let's talk about protein synthesis. Protein synthesis, or proteins, are one of four very important biological compounds in our body. And before you took this class, you probably learned what the building block of a protein is. Anybody know what the building block of a protein is? It's an amino acid. That's right. So we can take amino acids and join them together one after another, after another, after another, and we can make a protein from that. Other kinds of biological compounds that we don't get into very much in here would be carbohydrates. That's a different class of biological compounds. Lipids is another class. And the last class are nucleic acids that make DNA and RNA. Those are the four kinds. And we study those a lot in physiology, not so much in anatomy. Okay. But we do have to know something about protein synthesis. So protein synthesis requires amino acids. Okay. And so you could maybe consider an amino acid as being a letter of the alphabet. And what do you do with letters of the alphabet in your everyday life? What do you do? It's a building block of what? Letters in an alphabet are building blocks of what?
Words.
And words have meaning to us, right? It has meaning. So amino acids are like letters. You have to put them together in just the right way to create a meaning, right, to actually produce a protein that you want. So amino acids have to be put together in the right sequence in order to make the protein that has the proper meaning inside your body, right? And if you take a word with all the right letters, but you rearrange the letters in that word, what can you tell me about the meaning of that word? It changes, right? So if you have all the same amino acids in a protein, but you change the position of those amino acids in the protein, guess what you do to the protein? You change its function or its structure, and it probably won't work for you, right? So you got to get the amino acids in the right order, right? And where do you have that information that tells your body to put the amino acids in the right order? It's like the dictionary in how to build proteins properly. That is in the DNA inside the nucleus. And that's why we never want that dictionary to become corrupted, because you couldn't build any proper proteins when that happens, and the cell is going to die. Okay, so protein synthesis, we must break down into a couple processes. And we're going to start by talking about the central dogma in biology. And this is kind of a old, archaic kind of concept. We're learning a lot about molecular biology, but this is a really good place to start, all right, as we're learning things. So a couple important molecules are DNA. There's a cousin compound to it called RNA. These are very similar kinds of compounds. They're just a little bit different. And then RNA is used to make a protein. Right, the building blocks of DNA and RNA are nucleotides. That you don't know from your everyday life. You probably haven't heard that. All right, so building blocks of DNA and RNA are nucleotides. DNA, RNA, the building block are nucleotides. And I can show you some pictures of them. What is the building block of a protein? Amino acid. Okay. All right, so the central dogma says that the information that's in the dictionary inside the cell is in DNA. That information has to be converted into RNA, and that the information in RNA has to be converted then into a protein to get the protein that you want. So this graphic right here is kind of interesting, because how many steps are there? How many steps does it take to make a protein? In other words, how many arrows do you see? There are only two. So it requires two steps. Okay? Now, what can you tell me about these arrows? Is it bidirectional or is it a one-way street? It's a one-way street. You see an arrow with only one end to it, right? So information can only go from DNA into RNA and then finally into a protein, right? That's what we call the central dogma. And actually, that's really handy. Why is that really handy, that the information in protein can't go back to make RNA, or that information in RNA can't go back to make DNA? Because which ones of these molecules really define who you are and how your body functions? It's the DNA. Right? But what do you have in your diet all the time? What are you eating? Proteins. Okay? So this is a very good process right here, because tonight when you go home and have a chicken dinner, you don't ever have to worry about waking up in the morning with a beak or feathers, because those proteins that you just ate can't influence who you really are. It can't influence the DNA inside your body. Okay? So that's kind of the importance of this central dogma. All right, so it goes always DNA to RNA to protein, never the reverse. So we say DNA directs the production of proteins. Proteins can't direct the building of DNA. All right? All right, so it's a two-step process. The names of those two steps are transcription and translation. Couple big words. It might work for you to actually look these words up in the dictionary to know what their English meaning is, but we're going to talk about it. But you know, sometimes when you look something up in the dictionary, it makes more sense. You'll remember it for a little bit longer period of time. All right, so let's talk about transcription. It's this first arrow. So transcription is the conversion of information from DNA into which one? RNA. Okay. And we want to know where transcription takes place. Where does it take place? And that's defined by where you find DNA. Where is DNA located? There's only one place. Inside the nucleus. So therefore, transcription has to take place in the nucleus. That's the only choice because that's where it's protected. Otherwise, DNA gets corrupted. Okay, so what does transcription mean? Say we were, it was 2,000 years ago, all right, and I gave you a big book, and I say, I want you to transcribe that book. I gave you that book that had a couple thousand pages in it, like maybe a Bible or something. What would you have to do? Yeah, you make a copy. You'd have to get a couple boxes of feathers, right, a couple gallons of ink, you know, a couple cases of candles and light them and sit there and actually turn one page and then copy it down letter by letter, making what? Pretty much an exact duplicate. That's what we call a transcript. But if I give you a book today and I want a transcript, what would you do? You'd take it? Would you go buy a bunch of pens or light bulbs so that you could see what you're doing? What would you do? Yeah, you would just take it to a photocopy machine, right? And zip, 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 and now you would have a duplicate copy. So a transcript is really a duplicate copy. What about the information content in the copy compared to the original? It's the same information, right? And it should look almost the same. All right, so and if you want an exact copy of something, we call that a transcript. And a lot of times when you go on to another college or job or something, somebody might be interested in what classes you took here and what kind of grades you got. And so what would they ask you for? A transcript of your records, which is what? An exact duplicate copy, right? The information should be exactly the same. And no change in language or anything. So because the building block of RNA and DNA are the same, are these nucleotides, we call that transcription. RNA is basically a photocopy of DNA. The thing about this, the reason why this works really nicely, is because DNA never leaves the nucleus, so it's always protected. The RNA leaves the nucleus going into the cytoplasm, and if the RNA gets damaged, is that going to cause death of the cell? No, because the DNA is still there and healthy. It can make more RNA anytime it wants to, right? So RNA is just a working copy of the information that's in DNA, and it can be replaced, and you're still fine. Okay, so that is transcription. You got a couple kinds of RNA. You've got messenger RNA, which determines the sequence of amino acids, actually how to spell a protein out in terms of the sequence of amino acids. All right. There's a workbench where proteins are made, and you know where that is already. What does it look like? Where is that little workbench? It's an organelle in the cytoplasm where proteins are made. Okay, you haven't thought about it in this context yet, but what kind of organelles are responsible for protein synthesis? Let's go backwards a little bit. There are two. There's rough ER and ribosomes, and it just so happens rough ER has ribosomes on it, and so that's why protein synthesis can take place there. So ribosomes are the workbench where amino acids are put together. So ribosomes need amino acids coming from all different parts of the cell to make a protein, and the way that amino acids get from one place in the cell to another to make a protein is by taking a taxi. All right, so it hops in a taxi, goes to a ribosome, incorporated into a protein. We don't call it, we should have called it that, but we don't call it taxi RNA. We call it transfer RNA, right? So transfer RNA just carries amino acids around to the ribosome so that a protein can be made. All right, so what kind of process makes a transfer RNA? What kind of process? Transcription. Where does it take place? Inside the nucleus. Inside the nucleus, yeah. And that's just a copying of information from DNA to RNA. And should that information change? Nope, should be the exact same information. All right, second step is what we call translation. All right, you can look up translation in the dictionary. I recommend you do. You probably know what it means. What does translation mean? Anybody have an idea what translation means? It means taking information in one language and converting it into another language. Like maybe having information in Farsi and converting it into Mandarin. All right? That's translation. Now, should the information change? No. If it's high fidelity translation, the language changes, but the information doesn't change. Right? So we call this translation because what's the building block of RNA and DNA? Nucleotides. That's one kind of language. But what's the language of a protein? Amino acid. So it's going from one language to another language. Information should be what? Exactly the same. Not damaged, not changed. But it just goes from one language to another because the building blocks are different. Okay. So where does translation take place? It happens not in the nucleus, but in the cytoplasm, right? Because that's where ribosomes are. So translation happens in the cytoplasm. So that's what I want you to know about protein synthesis, okay? The two steps, where each of those steps takes place, and what step and which step is transcription and which one is translation. Somebody have a question? Yeah. Sure. Let me see if I got a picture that's not too complicated. Maybe. Okay, messenger RNA is like a word. And you got building blocks of a word, which are letters. Okay, the messenger RNA has nucleotides that make it up, okay? And there are really only four nucleotides. So there are four letters that make up an RNA. And I'll abbreviate the letters, all right? There's some that are uracil, so that's a U. I don't know if you actually have to know this, but it's kind of handy to see a little graphic. There is, right, adenine, okay? What else we got? Cytosine, guanine, those are the four, okay? And, okay, so these are the four. Somebody see another one? Thymine. But thymine we have in DNA, okay? A little complication. When you're a scientist, you really love all this stuff. Okay, that's really good. But that's in DNA, not necessarily in RNA. That's not so important for this class, okay? All right, so if we change the order of these nucleotides around, right, we change the meaning of this word right here. And so the job of translation is to take these different nucleotides, this sequence right here, and convert it into a sequence of amino acids. Like a good amino acid would be maybe like glycine, bound to a guanine. No. What's another one? Alanine. Okay. Tyrosine. All right, and if you change the sequence of nucleotides in the messenger RNA, what do you change over here? The order of these amino acids that make up the protein. And if you change the order of amino acids that make up the protein, you totally change its function, and that might kill the cell. As a matter of fact, a lot of times if you change just one nucleotide, that can change the protein enough to produce severe disease in the body. So does that sort of answer your question a little bit? Okay, so this step of going from messenger RNA to protein, what would I label this arrow right here? What do we call that step right there? That step is what we call translation, right? So it's going from one language, a nucleotide language to an amino acid language. That's translation. Yeah. Okay. Well, these building blocks are different. These are nucleotides, and these are amino acids. All right. So just maybe think of them as words. And the way we spell out this particular protein is by using the proper amino acids. And the cell knows how to spell the protein word out properly because it has the correct sequence in nucleotides all the way back in DNA, which gets converted into RNA through transcription. And then this leaves the nucleus, goes into the cytoplasm, and it joins with a ribosome. And the ribosome, using this information, can make this protein as long as it gets amino acids from other parts of the cell when transfer RNA brings it to the ribosome. Okay. All right, so, you know, that whole step right there, that's like a whole course in itself. It's really nice. And a lot of processes in medicine, like when we build drugs, there are various hormones that people need because they lost endocrine glands, like maybe their pituitary gland or something, right? We can teach bacteria how to do that kind of stuff to make drugs to give people so we don't have to, like, crunch up dead people's pituitary glands to get those hormones to give to people. All right, so basically what I just iterated was what I want you to know for protein synthesis, right? Two steps. It's one way. The first step is transcription. That's converting information in DNA to RNA. Happens in the nucleus. The second step is translation. That converts information from RNA to a protein, and that happens in the cytoplasm because that's where the ribosomes are. Okay. And what about the reverse process? Does not happen. You can't change who you are by your diet. It can change how you function maybe a little bit. Okay. All right. Another topic, cell division. This kind of gets us to some important information that's going to be on the practicum starting Wednesday, next week. Right? So next week, not on Monday, but on Wednesday you have a practicum. Okay? And it's going to be on cell division, in particular mitosis. And let me pull up a picture, mitosis. Okay, so you're doing a lot of microscopy work. Okay, so let's talk about the practicum. Yeah.
Is it, you said next week, but you have it now on February 8th.
Okay, that's maybe a lecture test.
No, it says practicum 1, February 8th from Monday Labs.
Oh, yeah, Monday Labs is not next week.
Okay.
Because you're a week behind everybody. Because, you know, we didn't start. We started on Tuesday. I know, it boggles my mind. So I'm glad you mentioned that, because I'll probably be confused all semester long where we are, because we started on Tuesday, not on Monday. I like that sheet a lot. Yeah, go by that sheet. Okay, so next week, Wednesday, is the first practicum, and then in 2 weeks, Monday, you get a practicum. So what's on the practicum? You've got microscopes, so you got to know everything about the microscope. You got some good pictures to label. You probably have a quiz on the microscope before you take the practicum, but a practicum is going to be the real object of that microscope. Might be an arrow pointing at that lens that you look into. What's that lens you look into?
Ocular.
Yeah, right, 100% on the practicum for that. But now here's a little bit tougher thing. There is also mitosis, right? And you looked at mitosis slides underneath the microscope. Well, it's too difficult for us to set up 25 stations with 25 or 50 microscopes in the room. So what we're going to do is just make copies. So what I did is I took all the figures out of your book, sent them over to Sam's Club, made pictures out of them, and those are the things that will be on the practicum. Pictures what's inside your book. So even though you're not in lab, because I know you don't have a lot of time in lab for this first practicum, you've got the exam in your textbook, which is labeled properly. So here are three possible stations on the practicum that you might have, right? This one, and this one, right here. And you should be able to recognize them for what phase of mitosis they are. If there's a lead line pointing to something, then you should be able to reproduce how you put that label on, okay? And also, tissues could be on the first practicum. And again, we're not going to have tissues that you look at underneath the microscope. At least that's in my labs. Make sure you understand that to be true with your lab instructor as well. Your lab instructor might spice it up a little bit because they think maybe it's too simple just to have pictures out of your book. So make sure that you're in tune with your lab instructor. Lab instructors can change the exam however they want to. All right, but the plan is to have pictures in your book of all the different kinds of tissues. So if you can recognize a tissue from a picture in your book, all right, and the lead lines, you guys should do really well on the practicum, even though you have limited time in lab. All right, so next week I'm going to start talking about tissues. But today we got to finish up mitosis. All right, so that's the first practicum. So we know it's a lot, but I think if we just pare it down for you like that, that is really important. Okay, mitosis. What the heck is mitosis? Oh, I got to erase all this good stuff right here. What the heck is mitosis? Okay, mitosis is when we start with one cell, okay, and it grows and then it divides into two cells right here. That doesn't necessarily mean mitosis, but we got to describe something about these two cells. In a normal human cell, other than a sperm and an egg, does anybody know how many chromosomes are inside of a cell, a normal cell in your body? We call that a somatic cell. There are 46 chromosomes. And then after mitosis, how many chromosomes are in these two cells right here? You know what? There's 46 and 46. These, both of these cells right here, we call daughter cells. And this is what we call a parent cell. All right, so if there's 46 chromosomes here in the first daughter cell, 46 in the second daughter cell, what's the difference between these daughter cells being produced by mitosis? Nothing. All right, so that's the point of mitosis. It just makes more cells that are identical to each other. So the daughter cells are identical to the parent cell. You just have more of them. So why do you want to have mitosis? There are two reasons for mitosis. Why do you want to have, the question is, more cells in your body? Okay, somebody said growth. That's really nice. Don't say reproduction, because mitosis is reproduction, right? Don't use the same term to define what it is. That doesn't make sense. But I'd like growth. All right? At one point in time, okay, you were just a single cell. A sperm from your dad and an egg from your mom united. What do you call that process? You all know. That's fertilization. Yeah, that's fertilization, right? Okay, so right after fertilization, you got one cell. Okay, and the name of that cell is a zygote. And we all were just a single cell at some point in our life for a short period of time. All right? But that's kind of a boring stage of life, because if you're a zygote right now, you couldn't come to anatomy class and look through a microscope or take notes or anything, right? So what do you have to do? You have to get big. You got to add cells together. And now you're trillions of cells instead of just one cell. We call that growth. And what's that process called? Mitosis. Okay. Another thing that's real important is that not all the cells in your body live your whole lifespan with you. Some of them get damaged, right? Some of them wear out, like your skin cells. Well, as a matter of fact, you looked at some cells in lab from your mouth. You don't have those cells anymore, right? But you still have an okay mouth, because what happened? Mitosis replaced them, right? And skin cells, like if I scrape my skin just very gently like that, you know, I've got about a million skin cells underneath my nail and I just flick them off in that direction. But do I have to worry about losing those million cells? No, because mitosis is replacing those in my skin. That's no big deal. So replace old or damaged cells. That's the purpose of mitosis. And is that important? Yeah, because you're losing millions of cells all the time. One more example. Your blood cells, okay, die pretty frequently because they only live for 120 days. That's not even a semester. 120 days. Okay. Does anybody know how many red blood cells die in your body every second? Between 2 and 3 million. Okay, or is it between 1 and 2 million? Ah, dang, I forgot. Doesn't matter. It's what? Big number. Okay, it's a huge number. What do you call it when you start to run low on red blood cells? anemia. All right, so how many red blood cells does your body have to make every second so that you do not become anemic? Yeah, millions, right? Between 1 and 2 million red blood cells every what? Every second. So are you busy right now? I'm surprised that you can even take notes. You're so busy replacing all those cells. All right, and that those cells are being replaced by what kind of process? Mitosis. Okay. So, if we got 46 here and 46 here, but we're going to split the chromosomes up, all right, what happens if you split 46 chromosomes? How many are going to end up over here? Well, 23, and then 23. So before mitosis begins, these 46, right, have to be replicated, and they're joined together. Right? We don't really call it 92 chromosomes. We still call it 46, but we realize that they're joined together so that when things split apart, you end up with 46 over here. This special growth phase where chromosomes are replicated is called interphase. This is interphase. All right. And when DNA is being used or duplicated, it's in an extended form. It's when it has a thin filament spread out all over the nucleus. You can't see any chromosomes. That's how you recognize it underneath a microscope. All right. So here, I don't see any chromosomes anywhere. Let's see if I can zoom in. Zoom, zoom, zoom. Zoom. All right. I don't see any chromosomes. It just kind of looks gray background. Don't forget. Oh, I didn't tell everybody. I'm colorblind. Might not look gray to you, all right, but I don't see any structures inside the nucleus, right? It's homogeneous. So this is interphase. An interphase is what kind of phase? Growth. Not only are chromosomes replicated, but what else do you have inside the cell? You got a Golgi body? You don't want one up here and then down here. You want one here and one here, or maybe a couple, right? So Golgi bodies replicate themselves. What about centrioles? Well, you need some here and need some here. You got to make some extra copies during interphase, right? So that's the what happens during interphase. This is what it looks like. We can see centrioles paired up on one side of the cell. We see microtubules all over the place. But as mitosis starts, all of this chromatin that is extended and in a delicate form starts to condense. All right, it starts to condense, and now I can start to see the formation of chromosomes because those thin filaments are being wrapped and wrapped and wrapped onto like a thimble or a spool that you would wrap thread on, and it becomes big enough for you to see. And now I can see the centrioles starting to move to opposite ends of the cell. This phase is what we call prophase. So how are you going to know the correct order of phases for mitosis? Think of IPMAT, IPMAT. The first letter in this acronym, or these letters in the acronym, correspond to the first letter in the phase of mitosis, right? So we got interphase, prophase, metaphase, anaphase, telophase. That helps you remember the correct order of the phases of mitosis. Both of these phases that we see right here are prophase. This is early prophase, because I still see a little nuclear envelope that's containing the chromosomes, but over here it's completely disappeared. And the centrioles now are completely on opposite ends of the cell. So that's how we characterize prophase. Condensation of chromatin into chromosomes, disappearance of the nuclear membrane or envelope, and there's just a random orientation in chromosomes that we can actually see where the nucleus was. All right, those are some nice points for prophase. The next phase is the easiest to see, even underneath a light microscope. All right, so we can see chromosomes, and they're all lined up right smack in the middle of the cell. We can see the spindle apparatus. These are microtubules that are pushing and pulling the chromosomes, so they all line up right in the center of the cell. You can see the centrioles controlling the microtubules or the spindle apparatus. This is what we call the metaphase plate. And metaphase just means middle phase, right? Middle phase, and it's all the chromosomes are right smack in the middle. And if you look at these chromosomes right here, notice that there are two parts. There's one part here, and there's another part here. One is the replicated, and one is the original. and they're connected together at this centromere, and the centromere is connected to the spindle apparatus, and that leads us to the next phase, where these things right here are called daughter chromatids. Right, the daughter chromatids start to separate and migrate to other ends of the cell, which we have right here. When they start to separate, now we call these daughter chromosomes because they're split apart. So where do we have this nice picture? So now I can see the nice bright chromosomes being pulled to opposite ends of the cell. I see a dropout in signal right here that signifies what? That the chromosomes are actually separating. There are none right in the metaphase plate. This phase right here is anaphase. All right, separation of the chromosomes, anaphase. And then the last phase, the chromosomes are completely separated. Right? There, the cells start to pinch apart. We call this a cleavage furrow. This is the very last phase, and telo means end. So we call this telophase. Whenever you see the cells starting to pinch apart like this. All right, so mitosis is that process where the DNA gets separated into two daughter cells. All right, but there's another process that we talk about too. But it doesn't refer necessarily to the DNA or chromosomes that are separating. It refers to the rest of the cell. What's the rest of the cell called? Cytoplasm, okay? And the cytoplasm now is being separated into two daughter cells. That process is what we call cytokinesis. All right, so you should also know in what phase of mitosis does cytokinesis take place. And in this class, it is only in one phase. That's telophase, which is the last phase. You might be studying other kinds of cells and other classes that are more concerned about a lot more detail, and maybe telophase starts in anaphase under certain conditions. All right, but in this class, you're going to say cytokinesis happens all the time in which phase? Just telophase, right? Just telophase, and that's good. All right, that's a good place to start. All right, so that's it. Really good idea to stay on top of your pre-lecture reading assignments, so that you're familiar with terminology that I use. Those are in Blackboard. Probably the keys to the pre-lecture reading assignments are now popping up. You can check your answers with what's online. And who has a good suggestion for the weekly online quizzes? What should you study for the weekly online quizzes? The practice quizzes, right? The online practice quiz, right? Those are really helpful. And weekly online quizzes are open book, open notes, right? Okay. Yeah?
On Firefox.
Okay.
My system internet is pretty fast.
Yeah?
And then I was like,